potential item on the agenda. We've got a little bit of housekeeping as a committee, which is, I think, the subject fundamentally of the court proceedings. We don't want to get tangled up in those. It would be inappropriate in time. But as I was suggesting, we do want to try and understand, first of all, what contingency steps have been undertaken. And we read in the media that there does seem to be indications of contingency steps taken. And maybe we could just have a brief outline of what you are doing. But then secondly, I think most importantly, why did this happen at all? What lessons do we learn from it? And what do we do to ensure that we don't repeat it? I think that's the essential issue that we're trying to hear about. And, okay, so I'm not sure. It looks as though the Department of Transport has got its PowerPoint up first. I'm not sure if there's a separate presentation from Treasury, but there won't be. So you'll be here and we'll make your own comments from the side of Treasury if you need. Okay, so DG, welcome. And welcome to your team, and let's proceed right away.
The Honourable Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, Comrade Sharon Cloney, the Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee, thank you very much for this opportunity of allowing us to be before you, importantly presenting to you a better understanding of the challenges that we face in the bus subsidy sector. I would like to start by confirming, as you have, Chairperson, that it is common cause and public knowledge that a matter of this nature has reached the courts on more than one occasion. And as we present the information before you and are required to clarify particular issues, you may have particular limitations because of the court proceedings in relation to what it is that in the detail we can provide if it is potentially would adversely affect the court proceedings. So if you'll bear with us with that, we're here to answer the critical question of what really is the bus subsidy transport system, how does it work, and what really have been the challenges we have faced in relation to budget allocation with respect to it. And then, very critically, what is the nature of the intervention? What are we intending to do? And what steps have we already taken to attempt to resolve this particular matter in a manner that, quite importantly, ameliorates the potential disbenefits of this particular challenge. Honourable Chairperson, I'm here with officials from the department. I am also lucky to have the head of department of the Provincial Transport Department in the Western Cape Province, Mr. Tami Manyati, who is here with me. Dan Pretoria, CFO. Lesiba is responsible for bus subsidies, and Jan Davilius is JD, as we call it. Responsible for is currently the Public Transport Acting DVG. In the presentation, Chairperson, we'll be able to give you a sense of what the current contractual obligations are. Copies of the presentation are being made available to you now as we speak. We'll talk to you also about the subsidy distribution mechanism, the budget allocations, the shortfall for problems, the intervention mechanisms, conclusions, and what we perceive to be our implementation plan moving forward. Just very simply put, we need to clarify how the bus subsidy system actually operates. And we start off by the background, quite simply, is the white paper in 1996, which introduces this particular framework, which is followed on by the introduction of competitive tendering in 1997. And the contract regime that is prescribed therein is basically comprises of three different types of contracts. The first is an interim contract, which is ticket-based and basically allocated, agreed to upon on a month-to-month basis. The second is a tender contract, which is kilometer-based and tends to have a longer term arrangement between the bus contracting company and the provincial government in that particular province. And then we have negotiated contracts which are also kilometer based. The next slide just gives you a sense of the scale of the issue, because you need to understand the program in its entirety and understand clearly where the challenges are greatest and where and how the subsidy is distributed nationally. What we indicate on that particular slide is the fleet size, the number of estimated passengers in the current subsidy that's allocated per province by the national department. And indicates quite clearly where the biggest problems lie. And as we can see, in the next slide we'll elaborate on that and consolidate that information so you can see it. But importantly, what needs to be understood is the relationship between the various categories of contracts. The numbers of contracts, the split between tendered and negotiated, and interim contracts is as indicated in those pie charts, 82, which are tendered and negotiated, and 31 which are interim. Similarly, you would see that in the number of buses. Chairperson, we must just apologize. There seems to be a little challenge with your projector. It's cutting our slide on the left-hand side. Wherever it does that, we'll ask honorable members to please refer to their document where the slide is provided for. It's not our laptop, it's the projector. Thank you. So you'll forgive us for that, but it cannot be helped. We'll try to fix it now, but it's interrupting the presentation and it's rather not. We'd like to refer
I'm
you
sorry
to...
I'm not happy with the Treasury.
but being cut off.
We get cut by them. Cut by us.
Paper is expensive, they think. Chairperson, just on the last one, we quite clearly indicate the total subsidy split per province. And as you can see quite clearly, Gauteng with 40% is by far the province with the greatest split of allocation of the subsidy, followed very closely by KwaZulu-Natal on 18%, Western Cape 17%, and then Mpumalanga 10%. I must indicate, Chairperson, there are other challenges which we will not, which shouldn't be the subject of discussion here, but would like to clarify that the Gauteng arrangement has slight complications which arise out of old arrangements, historic arrangements that relate to certain responsibilities as they apply to the former TVBC state, and particularly some responsibilities towards the old Transvaal region, particularly in relation to Gauteng.
Just if I take the top line of that slide, I think that the important thing for us to grasp there is that although the number of tenders, the interim contracts, is less than half the number of tendered and negotiated contracts, in terms of fleet size,
the vast
number of
are in the interim
contract by 800 buses.
That is the important
question. And that obviously becomes material when we look at the challenge.
Okay, that's for noting, Chair. We'll come back and deal with the implications of that. basically, what we then describe to you clearly is the budget and allocation process. That's the scale of the service that has to be provided for by provincial departments in those various forms of contract with the contracted bus companies in this particular case. The subsidy allocation, therefore, is then motivated for annually. And what we indicate here is that the annually motivated increases for the bus subsidy baseline allocation have been done since the emergence of the contracting arrangement. And this was also provided for in terms of the requirement for restructuring of public transport, but also for the catering of growth and also dealing with current subsidy services. But in reality, I think what we're indicating is that the challenge has been that the increases in baseline, as we'll indicate in a later slide, up until 2009-10 financial year, which is the financial year that is to start in April, have somewhat been limited. Our subsidy allocation, we also indicate, has been allocated on the basis of inflation adjustment up until this financial year. And basically, because of the need to do the transformation program and the improvement of services in relation to IFPTN's integrated rapid public transport network, limited provision or no provision has been made for increased growth and numbers in passenger provision. So therefore, by definition, the increase that we'll demonstrate later on in that subsidy amount basically and the growth in the sector has not been aligned to the budget allocation in relation to that. So there we say from 2004-2005 up to 2007-08, the baseline increase was 5.5%, and that's traditionally in government your inflation adjustment, because on all subsidy programs, the inflation adjustment would be within the region of the 3-6% inflation target and would be allocated on that basis. However, the challenge that we faced is that in the same period between 2004-05 and 2007-08, we've had escalation in the cost of capital, in the cost of labor, in the cost of fuel. And that obviously in this particular period has averaged about 10-12%. Chairperson, we would like to indicate that the passenger growth in the same period, as indicated there, has averaged 10%. Now, what is important of these particular points that we're making? That in fact the challenge would have been better managed if in fact we had been able to, over that particular period, been able to align specifically the budget allocation to those increases that are indicated there in terms of those percentages. Chair, we then take you through the tables that illustrate clearly, at least for those financial years where the backlog, I would argue, started to accumulate. And we indicate a subsidy allocation for financial year 2005-2006. And I may ask at this point, for the purposes of the screen, that those numbers, if it says 3908 because of the cut, it's 3 billion. So what will that indicate to you is basically the variance between the MTEF request, which means the budget application, and MTEF allocation. And then we have a particular mechanism that exists which has allowed us over the years to be able to indicate and apply in relation to the adjustment budget, which happens in October, an application for an additional request in order to deal with matters of this nature, which in most instances are unforeseen or unavoidable, which in that particular financial year, the request for the allocation was 166 and its allocation was 19. The actual expenditure, therefore, by definition, in that financial year was 2.38 billion, and you then contrast that quite clearly against the allocation of MTF allocation as indicated above of 2.2, and you start to develop the deficit, which is an 85 million amount in 05-06.
Well, just to get the general picture,
okay.
When it comes to the adjustment request and allocation, really the request is based on what's being experienced in the field. Is the allocation calculated basically on an inflation-related adjustment?
Chairperson, my understanding of the adjustment allocation is that it has focused largely on compensation for fuel, and yet the request would largely focus on both the issues related to fuel and passenger growth and growth in demand. But in fact, I mean, we can come back and discuss. Yeah, we can come back and discuss that. We can come back and discuss all of that. But we just, so this methodology that simply paints the picture to you, we repeat for every year. This is information you have access to, but when we crystallize it like this, we hope that it becomes clearer in terms of what the real picture was in every financial year. It's contained in all budget documents, and this is information that you would know. The second is 06-07. Chairperson, I slowed down a bit in my description of 05-06 because I was deliberately trying to ensure that at least the honourable members understand the methodology. So if you allow me, I'll go much faster here, because if we understand how those tables work, we'll then indicate a shortfall of 06-07 in the amount of 321 million as opposed to 85 in the previous year, using the same methodology. The difference between MTF allocation and expenditure, and that gives you the shortfall. That then is subsidy allocation of 708, shortfall of 595. And finally, in financial year 08-09, which then gives us an accumulated shortfall, if you take all of those red numbers in the previous tables, of 1.187, which is basically the figure that's been spoken about of close to 1.2 billion. Chairperson, similarly, I must indicate that the projected expenditure in this particular case, because we are in February the 3rd, is indeed projected. It's not actual. We'll see what happens by the end of the financial year. The shortfall for province is giving you details of for analysis, but also just for more information so you can start understanding the detail of how that shortfall is broken down per province in terms of the allocation. But more importantly, I'll come back to this particular point. What we perceive to be the challenge in our proposed solution is importantly that amount that is in a green box. It might be in a yellow box in your slide, which is at the end, which is an amount of 883. That's the critical amount that we are currently and tasked to find, save, allocate, and resolve in order to deal with this crisis. Chairperson, just very simply put, that amount excludes the payment of March this year. So it's the December to February total amount which is really the crux of the challenge that we're dealing with. Now, if I may just indicate, the specific intervention has been led, I must indicate, by a committee of three ministers, the Minister of Justice, the Minister of Finance, and the Minister of Transport, who have been tasked with the responsibility of finding a solution to this particular problem. Our definition of the problem or the challenge as we see it is simply, firstly, that we are absolutely convinced that we have a solution from 1st of April 2009-2010, which is basically in 3 months' time. The vexing challenge is what we really do and resolve the shortfall that relates to the month of December, January, and February. The reason I also indicated in that table that we have excluded the payment for March is that principally in the way the subsidy scheme works, we make payments for a particular month in the following month. So we're quite comfortable that the payment for March will be made quite comfortably in the month of April, because then we will benefit quite simply from what is the first real increase in the subsidy, past subsidy allocation, which only happened from the 1st of April. That is the nature of the challenge. The nature of the challenge is not government's inability forever to pay subsidies. It is a cash flow challenge that relates to the 3 months. The month of November is excluded with the exception of the province of Gauteng. All provinces received their transfers from National Department for the month of November. In the province of Gauteng, we allocated an amount of about 126 million, which was transferred to the Gauteng Department in the period when it was required. And the Gauteng province seems to be facing particular challenges in relation to effecting the transfer. And that's what led largely to the court case that is in Gauteng. My understanding this morning, Honorable Chairperson, is that all the contractors have been paid in Gauteng this morning, and that has been finalized in relation to the month of November. So we almost treated the November challenge as different from December, January, February, because November indeed had money allocated to it and was available. The second important issue is that we are now then dealing and focusing specifically on the issues of the December, January, and February payments. What is important to indicate about that is that that amount, principally, is indicative of an increase expenditure in the bus sector arising largely from two factors. One is the unprecedented fuel cost escalation that we witnessed in this particular financial year, and second is the growth in passenger numbers that was seen in this particular area. If we just take 2008-2009 and isolate the problem, we have evidence to show that a significant or an unprecedented proportion of private car users in this financial year simply dumped their cars and went and joined the queues in the bus ranks because of the impact of fuel price escalation. The real challenge is that the compensatory issue in relation to this, as I indicated earlier, then deals with the issue of fuel, and therefore, by definition, results in potential over expenditure by the various provincial government departments. What are we doing about this? Led by this committee of ministers, we have looked at several interventions that would help us to identify various sources of funding to deal with the vexing question of December, January, and February. The month of March, as I said, will be paid in April, and from the 1st of April we see an increase in the subsidy allocation. But just in order to isolate the problem more clearly, our intention is also to establish a different legislative framework for the payment of the subsidy program from the 1st of April, which will be governed by the Division of Revenue Act. And that precisely would mean that the amounts allocated to the various provincial departments of transport would be stipulated in law, and basically we would have a program which would start at this point, which would allow them, encourage them, cajole them, ensure that by September of 2009 they have converted the interim contract into negotiated contract. And that, in effect, in our view, will substantially deal with the challenge at hand. So if we imagine that what we then are left with is the 3 months, because the future is, in our view, covered in the legislative arrangements, in the specific measures that we've put in the conversion of the contract from interim to negotiated and all of that. The specific challenge is how we deal with this. One of the interventions we are looking at is to find mechanisms for provincial departments to be assisted by their provincial treasuries to bridge finance this challenge. The first request we've made to all of them is that they need to find savings in their various programs and perform, Chairperson, what is known as virement from other programs, which basically are unlikely to have the same contractual obligation to transfer those funds to the specific bus program in order to ameliorate this problem.
So we're talking about the 3 month issue.
3 month issue. That's all that there is a crisis about. It's December, January, February. The rest is taken care of. And I thought I was describing clearly how we've separated and dissected the problem. The rest is covered. The issue is 3 months of payment. And in that particular instance, the first option would be to pursue virement, which would enable certain provinces to be able to shift funds, particularly in programs where they would not be incurring expenditure this financial year, to prevent, Chairperson, on the other hand, what you would be querying them and the provincial legislatures would be querying them about, which are potential rollovers. So by definition, we would utilize that mechanism. But however, I must indicate that there are various complexities in releasing funds for environment purposes, simply because those funds are governed by particular legislative instruments and statutory arrangements and administrative constraints that would mean in certain instances it is not possible or it is not easy to effect those particular changes. We must also indicate in this particular arrangement we have requested both the provincial and the national treasuries to make as far as it is possible for them available from the National Revenue Fund and Provincial Revenue Fund any savings that they would be able to secure so that we're able to resolve this problem as well. So the spirit of this is all of us contributing to a particular pot that attempts to resolve this problem in as far as it is legally permissible, administratively possible. But, Chair, it requires us also to look at some of the restrictive arrangements we may have and are asking particularly provincial treasuries to review in certain instances with limitations, of course, and specifically for this program, particular arrangements such as the percentage limitation on what virements can be made by individual departments in order to allow some flexibility in this case to help us to resolve the problem. In relation to that, Chairperson, I may confirm, as you may already know, that the payment for Golden Arrow was made with an amount of cash that was advanced to us by the National Treasury and which we made available to the Western Cape province to the tune of 94 million, and that amount has already been settled. The Gauteng instance yesterday, and I understand confirmed today, Gauteng has entered into similar arrangements in their case where they've been able today to confirm that they've made settlement and have met the requirements of their court order in relation to this particular issue. So what we are looking for, Chairperson, is that there needs to be a common understanding across government and importantly in the various legislatures and the various scopas that the nature of this particular problem is that it may well result in significant over expenditure in particular budget line items as they relate to transport because of this challenge that has arisen as a result of increased passenger growth and the issues related to the interim contract. So for that reason, we would request, and we are in the process of discussing, the requirement for a flexible arrangement to be adopted by all of us, accepting that this is the 1 year where we are going to have over expenditure and what is termed in the strictest PFMA sense, irregular expenditure as it is occurred in the various areas. In fact, by definition, the 94 million that is allocated by Treasury to us as cash translates on the National Department budget as irregular expenditure because it wasn't budgeted for. And that has already been occurred in order to facilitate the golden arrow payment and transfer from Treasury to the province. So by definition, this is what we perceive as one of the approaches that will help us to deal with the problem. The other chairperson is we did explore, and the extent to which is possible, the arrangements that would help us to facilitate a special adjustment budget, but we understand that there are grave difficulties with that, given the time frames of Parliament. But that, in effect, chairperson, would help us to relieve funds that are located in division of revenue allocation, and because division of revenue locks them up in law, it is only a special adjustment budget that would enable us to access those funds. That option basically has been pursued. We say it has very grave limitations, but there is one possibility of provinces that have been allocated funds for disaster. Both the province of Western Cape and the province of KwaZulu-Natal have been allocated funds for disaster, and they are likely to roll over in that. The only challenge is that that money was allocated via division of revenue. It's cast in law. The only way you can shift it is if, you know, you have a special adjustment budget. And then basically what we'd look for is the issues around unauthorized expenditure that are likely to happen. So, Chair, our view is very simple. It is that this problem, as it relates to the 3 months, is a problem that can be resolved. It would also be best resolved in relation to specific circumstances in each particular province, with the assistance both of the National Department of Transport, the National Department of Finance, Treasury, and the assistance of Justice as the department basically that's leading this process. And we are in the process of finalizing those specific arrangements that will help us to ameliorate the problem. In certain instances, I am informed that bus contractors who have confirmation that the subsidy increase is available from 1st of April and know that it is there and they have no doubt that it is there, are indicating that they could be persuaded to await the payment in 1st of April instead of getting it now. But that's some of them, and not many of them in this particular instance. So we would take advantage of that subsidy increase that comes 1st of April also to deal with this particular challenge and basically pay back. So effectively what we're looking for in most instances is, if you like, a solution that is akin to a cash flow bridging finance mechanism that allows us to then readjust and restore come 1st of April in the new year. What we're indicating there is that the 9-10 framework, which we have discussed with National Treasury at quite some length, and are quite clear that all of us would want this particular arrangement in place on 1st of April, basically constitutes of that framework, the conversion of interim contracts, the alignment with integrated rapid public transport networks. We give you a sense of what the contracting authorities would have to do in developing the network, setting KPIs, identifying stakeholders, implementing the balance of the program and the capacity requirements they would have in those instances. And what is important, Chairperson, is something that we have discussed at least with SABOA or members of SABOA around the solution that may come out of this. It is very important for all of us to accept, including the bus contractors and operators, that interim contracts are clearly not the most appropriate mechanism that should be utilized for the purposes of this program. And in fact, if you go back to the table that you quite clearly pointed out, Chairperson, it is the reduction of the interim contract on that table that becomes a critical priority not for government departments, but for the contractors as well. And I'm absolutely convinced that they are aware of that. They're aware of the implications of that. They're also aware, Chairperson, that the negotiated arrangements are better for all of us because they allow us to have better budgeting arrangements. They allow us to be able to focus what is required. Interim contracts are ticket sale based. The amount that is spent is at anybody's guess. And by definition, the head of department of each province must sit there on a month-to-month basis making adjustments on the basis of what is likely to be effective demand. The challenges that the province will indicate to you is that in that arrangement, you are unable to then say, sorry, don't provide that service, when there are human beings waiting out there, when there are buses ready to provide the service, and where basically a service must be provided for workers to get to their jobs. That difficulty that is presented by interim contract is a difficulty that we must definitely overcome. But more importantly, it may well also be that the bus contractors do prefer the interim contract for many reasons. And at least we all have an acceptance. It might be preferred, it might be better, but it is not correct that we have a disproportion between interim contracts and tendered contracts because it deprives us of the certainty of budgeting that we so need to be able to know what we need in each year in order to be able to do that. We're absolutely certain on the tender and negotiated, but when it comes to interim, it's demand-based and it can end up anywhere. And that's why, Chair, you would sit in the month of November and be told there's no money, simply because what you would have allocated for that, the ticket sales that would have happened on a month-to-month basis from April in that year, would escalate beyond your own projections towards the end of the financial year. You would find that there isn't enough there to be able to do it. But the issue and the argument that the provinces will use, you are not in a position to then say, stop, provide less, because of the social economic implications of that, and it is really a difficult challenge that they face. As we move forward, Chairperson, we would be able to indicate basically in our conclusion that the issue has been the allocation in relation to 05 in relation to the challenges of growing services. Might I also indicate that part of that is also in relation to new areas of development, the growth of housing projects and developments in various areas, which have meant that even in the original program, those things were not catered for, but in certain instances, the service had to be provided and had to be given. What we then do is basically focus on the operational and financial efficiency and a more focused program to determine service priorities in the framework of the division of revenue as we move forward, which provides us a lot more certainty than interim contracts have provided us. Importantly also to say, because this needs to be done in relation to the integrated rapid public transport network, I must say, Chairperson, we've made significant progress in getting various provinces, particularly various cities, to do the design of those new networks which are integrated. Cape Town was the first to finish their work. They concluded their work more than 18 months ago. Johannesburg, Tswane, Etegwini, Msunduzi, the list is endless. There are clear areas where we can indicate that the integrated rapid public transport networks have been completed, and as a result, the new kilometer-based arrangements can be applied, but more importantly, the transformed bus subsidy can exist in essence. The issue, though, Chairperson, is that in order to roll those out, you would have needed this increase that comes in the financial year 9-10. And in fact, by definition, that's why the increase was provided for, to be able to make a shift to the new system and make sure that you're able to extend it. And it is that would see as an important milestone. And the commitment would be from us, at least from provinces, to be able to conclude that process by September of this year, so that everything has been transformed onto the new arrangement. The implementation plan, We're looking at phased implementation and cooperation with provinces, negotiated performance-based contracts for route operations, formalization of unscheduled interim contract services, defining operational areas that will not be served, because principally this program must be driven, and it will be, by the amount that is allocated in the budget, and that would in particular instances indicate how we need to change modes of travel or realign passengers to other modes where there are limitations. The implementation of supporting infrastructure, continued enforcement and monitoring of all contracted public transport operations. That, Chairperson, hopefully gives you a better sense of where we're at. The provincial treasuries, provincial departments are all in negotiation and have been since late last week around finding the specific solutions. We have dealt with the court cases in the financial implications that arise out of that, and solutions have been and are being found for the balance of the challenge as it remains in various ways, as I described to you, the various options that are being sought in the form of overexpenditure, savings, environment, and all sorts of other ways to enable provincial departments to make good and settle the debt they have with the bus operators. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for that. I'll open it up, obviously, for members to ask questions, and we'll also obviously create the space for colleagues from Treasury who might want also to add or to agree or disagree with whatever we've heard. I mean, in short, I mean, I think there's three fundamental issues we've got here. DG. I'm saying that I think that there are three fundamental issues that we've got here. You're reassuring us that it'll all be hunky-dory off come April. Okay. That's good to hear. And obviously, we'd like to probe a little bit more into exactly, I mean, you've laid it out, but I think that requires further cross-questioning. I suppose the immediate question that then emerges, if it's so easy to sort it out by April, why have we allowed ourselves collectively, and let's not point fingers at provinces, with the bomb, that the bomb, and all parliament, because it's also our job too. But I suppose the question is, why have we allowed the crisis to brew to the scale that we find it at the moment? So I don't want to dwell too much on that, other than to say, if it's as easy, as you're saying, to sort it out by April, I think we must assume collective responsibility for not having done it a lot sooner, because we've seen this coming, as your own presentation said. Okay, the next immediate issue is, in a sense, you're asking Parliament to condone unauthorized expenditure. Now, obviously, we can't as a committee do that. Well, you're going to have to ask later, and we you know, this Parliament, which is about to end, can't do it, and this committee can't do it. Mm-hmm. But what we can do, and I think it will be useful for you to be able to say that, is that precisely at our last meeting we said there's a crisis now, and whatever the niceties of the budgeting process, and we must respect those and be meticulous about it, we can't allow a human scale crisis, which it's going to be, 1.5 million people might be without transport, nearly 30,000 jobs might be lost. We urge government to find creative ways of tiding us over the thing, but not to allow those creative ways to become a pattern. And that's in a sense what you're briefing us about. So I hope that my committee will support me in saying that for what it's worth, we can't condone it as such formally, but certainly you can say that this matter was presented. It was presented publicly in the plain light of day, which is what the Parliament is hopefully about, and that certainly the committee that you presented to do was not only sympathetic, but was calling for something like this to tide us over. So I hope members will support that. Then the third thing is, I think, for them to look more closely at the proposed solution and to get a better understanding of those. Those strike me as being... So let's leave this, unless the members want to spend more time on the first thing. The first thing was really just to say, let's collectively admit that we've allowed a crisis to brew, and apologise for that, and say that
let's use it now creatively, and I think that's what's being suggested. There is a crisis, and let's use that now as leverage on ourselves, on operators, on provinces, on whomsoever, to realize that we can't go on like this, and we've got to be bold and bite the bullet and do things that have to be done. So let's leave that one, unless other members want to comment on that. But I think we should say that it's wrong that this is allowed, that we allowed it to brew. And let's not, as I say, point fingers, let's collectively apologize, and let's now focus on responding effectively to the challenge. Okay. So then, the core thing, I guess, without preempting what other members might want to say, and I've got a lot of things to raise, but I'll hold off, is around what now is the future. You've laid it out a bit, but I think we need to get a whole lot more clarity on that. Let me open up then for members to... Lenny?
Yes, thanks, Chairperson. It comes at a very critical time. But be as it may, of course, it will be a little bit also necessary to hear from Treasure what informed their responses. Because according to this report, you understand that this is a story that started in 1997, that has been this particular short form. If ever there was any wisdom in doing that, not responding to the COT budget requirement, it is just the crux of the matter, simply to actually put us in a position where, you know, as we accept collectively that we have come to this particular point, but at least we know what informed them, and we will be knowing how they will be treating other requirements in future, budget requirements. I think that is the point that I would be waiting to hear from Treasure. I don't think I've got no issue with the TOT, given the particular report that I've seen. Thank you.
Okay, let's start there then. And someone from Treasury, maybe, I mean, obviously what we've had is that over 3 years,
the department's been saying the baseline's not moving up sufficiently, and the increased allocations that they've been asking for, both the original budget request as well as the increase that they asked for mid-year, clearly in the version that we've got, have not been met. And if we could have some explanation about those, what might have been.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. My name is Andrew Donaldson. I'm responsible for public finance in the National Treasury. And I have here with me Mahesh Fakir, who is the head of our infrastructure and urban development team, and Marissa Moore, who is responsible for budget-related work on the transport function, and Temekile Plaike, who is in our parliamentary office. Let me first say that I very much welcome the outline of the way forward that the Director General has shared with us. We met with her and with heads of the provincial transport departments last week, and we have in fact been involved in the challenge of finding the cash that's needed to deal with the immediate problem of shortfalls in the funds available for existing contracts, and also, really more importantly, as you have indicated, Chair, in looking at how we proceed in future. And I think the Director General has set out very well the background to the position that we have that we now find ourselves in. I want to respond specifically to the question of what has informed Treasury's response, and in particular to the concern that in effect was laid on your committee's table last week with the suggestion by the Transport and Allied Workers Union that Treasury has in some sense withheld funds for this function. And I want to explain a bit about how the budget process works and how cash management works in year once a budget is in place. Difficulties like this arise as a result of failures in the budget process, and I think we do need to acknowledge that there is a very substantial failure that lies behind the cash position that we are in at present, and that's what we have to address going forward, and the DG has indicated several of the key steps that will be taken in that respect. We haven't got the budgets right, we need to understand why, but we also need to understand why the Treasury Committee, when it met last year, was unable to accede to the request for an additional 1.3 billion rand. Now, I want to say that, and indeed the Director General has set out quite in some detail the background to these services. I want to say that the financing of public transport is a particularly complex area of public finance. These are services that are partly paid for by users, by commuters themselves, and partly paid for through the fiscus. That's a complication in itself. There is a very substantial, deep historical legacy that we are dealing with here, in which expensive long-distance commuter services were embedded in the spatial geography of apartheid South Africa, and we recognized in the early 1990s that that was not a sound basis for long-term development and planning, that over time this reliance on long-distance commuting needs to give way to more integrated cities and better spatial planning. And that is a very important background to, if you like, the constraint that has been exercised in budgeting for the subsidization of these bus services over the course of the last decade. But secondly, we had to recognize that the intergovernmental relationships for financing of public transport are complex. There is a substantial subsidy for these services on the national budget that the DG is responsible for. There are also several substantial contributions to public transport that are on provincial budgets, in some cases inherited from old homeland financing arrangements, and there is a very substantial role of municipalities and local government in financing services. And we recognized in 1997-98, more than a decade ago, when the structure of the division of revenue between national and provincial and local government was being put in place, and when the conditional grants were introduced into the relationships between national government and provinces and municipalities, we recognized then that the existing arrangements, the existing financing arrangements for public transport, were not founded on sound, sustainable, long-term objective criteria. That it would not be possible to divide up the resources on the national budget between provinces in a way that both was fair and objective, which is a constitutional requirement, and at the same time adequately took account of the existing services with, as I say, the deeply embedded historical legacy in those. And so we ended up with an interim arrangement, interim not just in the details of specific contracts, which have gone on as interim contracts since then, but also interim in the sense that the balance of responsibility between the national budget, provinces and municipalities was interim and needed to be addressed, and interim in the sense that it was recognized, and of course the legislation that that has been through several amendments, National Transport Act, Land Transport Act, and the transport authorities that are envisaged in that act not being in place also meant that the financing arrangements were of an interim nature. And so, at that stage, public transport funding was not brought into the division of revenue and brought into the conditional grant framework. Now, we have agreed that that should be done from next year, and that's an important part of addressing the difficulties that have emerged. I think, looking back, we probably need to acknowledge that it has taken us too long to address those interim problems, both in respect of the share of resources, the share of funding of public transport between the national government, provinces and municipalities, and in the restructuring of the contract. Case of the Golden Arrow contract, signed in 1997 as a three-year contract, now close to 8 or 9 years, as an interim contract, and one that is more expensive than it needs to be, and has not sufficiently provided for a modernization and a rationalization of those services, as the DG has indicated. Now, I need to say something also about our three-year budgeting system. The Public Finance Management Act prescribes that budgeting should be done on a three-year basis, and our first MTF, of course, was tabled in 1998, so it has now been in place for 10 years, and essentially it puts in place three-year numbers with two-year forward estimates within which departments plan for future services. And the first step in the budget process each year is, in effect, a request to departments from the Treasury, provincial treasuries to provincial departments, to re-examine and reprioritize their baseline allocations, partly to ensure that new priorities are addressed in that revision of numbers, but also, of course, to ensure that existing commitments are adequately funded. And I think we have to acknowledge that in this particular case, our bus subsidy financing arrangement, the reprioritization, which is the first step in the budget process each year, to ensure that existing contractual commitments are budgeted for, has not adequately been done. And I think part of the reason for that, and I would be the first to say that as Treasury, we have not looked at this closely enough in the course of each year's budget process. But I think part of the problem is here that there has been a rather awkward balance of responsibilities between the national departments and provinces for managing these contracts and therefore managing contracts within the envelope of resources available to them. Indeed, in some provinces, there has been an awkward tension between what should be recovered from the national department and what should actually be met from the province's own resources. And so the present agency relationship between the national department and provinces has been unsatisfactory, and I think is part of the reason why we have ended up with budgets in which even existing commitments, before we come to extending commitments and providing for new services, have not adequately been provided for in the baseline. Now, you can't budget like that. You can't have a budget system in which existing commitments are not budgeted for when the budget is tabled in Parliament in February, and you then later in the year come back and through some kind of adjustments process provide a second chance to departments to bid for funds. Indeed, the UK and several other countries are in the process, or in the recent years have moved towards allowing a full budget process only every 2 years. We still do an annual budget process. We think it's probably necessary to do that. But it's not realistic to expect Treasury to manage to give departments a second chance to open up budgeting requests for existing services. And so the PFMA, and this is broadly in line with international practice, but it is a considerable constraint on discretion of treasuries and discretion of the executive, the PFMA requires that adjustments should only be made to budgets if they meet certain criteria. And the key criterion here is unforeseen and unavoidable spending obligations. And it simply isn't plausible to regard the meeting of existing contractual commitments as meeting that requirement. And that's why last year the Treasury Committee, which is a committee chaired by the President, on which cabinet ministers, the Director General of the National Treasury sits, was unable to agree to an adjustment allocation to supplement the bus subsidy amount. However, the PFMA also recognizes that it isn't possible to be completely precise about exactly what the claims on any particular subcomponent of a subdivision of a vote are going to need to meet from one year to the next. And so there are specific provisions in the PFMA that provide for, as the DG has indicated, violence within a program or between programs of the vote, and there is some scope, therefore, for in-year adjustments. But the Treasury does not, and I need to emphasize this because the allegations have been made in public, the Treasury has in some sense withheld funds for this program. The Treasury does not play a role in the cash management of spending on individual programs or individual components of a vote. The in-year relationship between departments and the National Treasury or departments and provincial treasuries is about cash management for the requirements of the vote as a whole, and so the responsibility for ensuring that spending on particular programs, in this case the bus subsidy program, remains within the approved and authorized allocation, is not a job the Treasuries do, and it's not a job the Treasuries could in practice do, because there are many hundreds of thousands of contracts that government departments are responsible for. Treasury does not get involved in managing the details of each of them. And so, in here, from a cash management point of view, we do what we can to ensure that there is a match between the cash flows, the drawdowns that are available to departments, and their actual spending. Departments are free to apply to Treasury for changes to those, and indeed those changes happen from time to time. Those discussions have happened over the last few weeks to ensure that the cash requirements of this program are met, that the contractual obligations of government to bus operators are met, and we will ensure that that is done for the rest of the financial year. But that is a separate question from the question of adhering to the PFMA's requirement for authorization of expenditure by Parliament. And quite rightly, the PFMA does not simply allow the Treasury or any department to change budgets that are approved by Parliament during the course of the year without recourse to Parliament itself. Thank you.
Okay, I mean, your last comment, I think for those who don't understand things are legitimate. I don't think that was the nub of the question. The nub of the question was, looking back now, was the department not right to say in its budget request that there's a serious shortfall? And I think why was the Budget Committee unable to appreciate the argument put forward? Why is it that we are now realizing collectively that there was a shortfall in allocation? There might, I mean, and you've gone part of the way to answering that, saying it's complicated, it's different spheres of government, it's an anomalous area because you've got private operators who are drawing some of their cash flow from collecting fares, but also they're getting subsidies. We agree it's complicated, and we agree that it needs to be a lot more rationalized and so on. But the nub of the question, which was asked, is there an agreement that there was a miscalculation, not necessarily narrowly in the Treasury, but in the Budget Committee, let's call it that, and that the department's broad request might have been a little bit excessive, but fundamentally there's been a shortfall, and we're running into that now.
I think, Chair, the answer is that we have all been unrealistic about the scope for achieving more efficient services here through the transition to negotiated contracts. We have all been unrealistic about the time that it has taken to put transport authorities in place, and we've not put sufficient work into renegotiating between national government, provinces and municipalities the share of responsibility for funding these services. Now, in the first instance, as I want to emphasize, the job of ensuring that existing contractual obligations are met within the baseline that the department has at its disposal is the job of the department itself. That submission made to Treasury says, here's our reprioritization of baseline, and the public transport baseline here doesn't just cover bus subsidies, it is this year a 12 billion rand program that includes the very substantial funding line for the Rail Commuter Corporation. We have also, over the last few years, put in very substantial additions to the overall transport envelope to accommodate new rapid bus transport services, to put in place new infrastructure for public transport. But we have not adequately budgeted for the ongoing operating costs of existing contracts. And if I may speak very generally here, because I don't think it's helpful to say, you know, who should have done what. If I may speak very generally here, public finance literature is full of examples of exactly this mistake. The mistake is to underemphasize the operating costs of existing services and to put all the emphasis on the new things that need to be added. And it's, if you like, a short-sightedness in budgeting that very commonly arises. The rules of the game, the insistence on reprioritizing and the first step, making sure that existing obligations are met, those are the rules of the game. But it's very hard to avoid those rules and say, no, let's concentrate the additional resources on the new things we want to do instead of ensuring as a first step that existing commitments are met. And I can give lots of examples of that from other areas. In the end, it's a challenge in budget systems. Putting a clear budgeting system in place helps, but when there are shared responsibilities between three spheres of government, when there is the scope for perhaps shifting this year's spending into next year with the deferral of the January and February and March payments until the following year, that creates a problem that then escalates in subsequent years. Very easy to get into that kind of trap. It's clearly something we need to correct going forward, and as we move into a new financing arrangement for next year, we need to ensure that this year's commitments are fully met.
Listening to that, I think implicit in what you were saying was we've contributed to the international literature on public funding with yet another example of an underestimation of an exaggeration of the possibilities of shifting to a new dispensation. And I think we must all take collective responsibility for the slowness with which we've done that, whether it's the legislative process, which has been a complicated one in this area, or other things. But also, I think, and I'm not trying to point fingers, really. I think that what's most important for all of us collectively is to learn lessons from this thing. So that and the best way of learning lessons is to be quite transparent and to share collective responsibility rather than to try and shift it around. And I guess if just what you're saying, in effect, is that one of the lessons we need to learn from this, and it's not just Treasury, but perhaps Treasury is the lead player in that, is that there's a danger of underestimating the current expenditures, current services, and so on, as we try to seek to move on to a new one. And I think if that's a lesson we collectively learn, that's a lesson usefully learned. So can we hold on to that? I think we would all concede that's not the job of Treasury to be to manage the budget. But the allegation, of course, is that the budget you gave us was an impossible one to manage, given the services we're trying to provide, and there can be some dispute about that. But okay, Lennis, I'm quite keen to move. As I said, it's important to do this, so we try to learn the right lessons. But the main thing is, what do we do, and how do we go forward? Not just on the contingency front, but much more now, where you're trying to move. Because I think that then a number of issues still arise around what's being proposed for April and beyond, and I think we need to interrogate those. But let me ask Lennis to make his contribution.
If I had proper, it seems as if the budget allocation may have been used as punitive action to get the department to do certain things that it was not doing. in terms of the Treasury Department, if I heard correctly. But whether it's correct or not correct, that's a little bit afraid, citizen, that when people go on strike and they go to the court, then we get some money out to actually deal with a particular challenge. And I'm worried that the face of government now is to say that we are only able to listen to court orders and matters, but we can't proactively deal with methods of government that are required to actually ensure that we give service to our people. I think that is what we need to turn around. We can't be in a situation where we only respond to court orders. We respond to people marching on the street for us to do what it is required to do under the circumstances. There may be challenges, there are all sorts of challenges, but at the end of the day, that we need to give a service to our people. But if people are going to learn that when they march or they go to court, then they get what they're supposed to get, I don't think that is the character of government that we are supposed to be.
Okay. That was a comment. I'm not sure. Can we shift then to what we're supposed to do? Just see if I've understood correctly. That, in a sense, it's an opportunity. I mean, and maybe not, and let's not assume that it's being used cynically, but it's an opportunity to make some of the changes we needed to make. And in particular, to move out of these interim costs. So that's a very critical step that we've got to make if there's any kind of sustainable approach to getting this right. And we call them interim because we all agree that they were interim, but obviously interim has now got quite long lasting for perhaps the major beneficiaries of the subsidy. So although there are more non-interim contracts, the bus that's under the interim, and that's why that's specific group for the bus. Providing for under interim contract is larger than the non-interim. Okay. Now, the suggestion is that we move from interim to negotiate. The first
question that emerges is I can understand why one would go from interim to negotiate it as a stepping stone, but clearly I assume that our policy perspective, and also that's what we've written into legislation, is that the objective is to move to tendered contracts and not endlessly negotiated contracts either with the same parties and so on. But clearly, in order to move from the interim arrangement into which we locked, so that would be a correct understanding. So the notion of moving to negotiate it is a way of beginning to make the shift with incumbents, basically, so that we're not trying to do too many things all at once and end up with a set of another set of legal problems, court challenges, and so on. So I've got that right, okay? Then the next critical thing is we're saying that we're going to be placing the allocation of subsidies under DORA, under the Division of Revenue Act. Okay, now I'm sure all the other members understand that better than I do, but the first question I want, I suppose, the key to, if I understand that rightly, the sum, the budgeted sum, will not now be located in all kinds of places. The bus subsidy allocation will be an allocation that is provided for in terms of DORA, that act. And therefore, we will have, and say a province will have, a clear understanding of exactly what's allocated. And it's not getting drawn down from a variety of different confusing places where none of us is sure. Is that a correct understanding of the first advantage of doing that? Clarifies the thing? Yeah. Okay. Now, we've been talking about provinces. So my next question is we're saying provinces, but the legislation that we've just passed here in Parliament, and I'm hoping our President will sign off on it quicker than some of the other legislation maybe that hasn't signed off on, envisage, says, basically, that the subsidy function, and when it comes to buses, is a national competence. Okay. So we've tried to, the schedules in the constitution are a little bit unclear. We've said a national function to be assigned to the appropriate sphere of government according to needs, requirements, capacities, and so forth. But what underpins that is a commitment to move as quickly as possible, especially in the case of the host cities, for the subsidies, bus subsidies, to be controlled by Metro, where they can and where they should. And the idea behind that relates to some of the other things that both Andrew and Pumi mentioned, is the irrationality in the system we've got currently. So spatial planning, for instance, is done, and integrated public transport plans are done at the city level, but key leverage to actually get those things to work, obviously one key component of leverage would be a subsidy. If you've got one entity administering the subsidy, it might be inclined to enter into contracts which bear little resemblance. I'm not saying that would necessarily happen, but that's the danger. They bear little resemblance to the planning, integrated planning, both transport and broader spatial planning, that is required to be done essentially at the municipal level and particularly at the metro level. So, sorry, that's a long speech, but question. When we talk about DORA and talk about provinces, because everyone talks about provinces, are we allowing for what we are envisaging in law now, that the subsidy should be administered diversely by provinces and by metro, because that will be the reality. One envisages provinces administering subsidies for smaller towns, for rural areas, but for the metros. And so is what you're planning to do from April not out of the line with that possibility? Pumi?
Chairperson, if I may indicate, the legislation in the form of the National Land Transport Bill is a very important piece of legislation in as far as establishing the appropriate institutional arrangements that take us forward. The Division of Revenue Act as well is equally an important instrument to manage for us the financing arrangements of public transport financing in the context of the NLTB. In fact, Chairperson, the Division of Revenue Act is already used for public transport infrastructure grants, and those are allocated directly to municipalities in this particular case. The challenge that we would face in directly aligning the Division of Revenue implementation with the provisions stipulated in the National Land Transport Act, as we hope it will all shall soon be, is only a question of time lag in implementation. So, by definition, at the point at which a metropolitan authority has the necessary institutional arrangements that have been prescribed clearly and provided for in the National Land Transport Act, they will qualify to then receive the subsidy mechanism that allows them to align the functions and perform the functions. But, Chair, we must also know that transport is one of the functions that has different functional areas compared to municipal boundaries. So, by definition, in Cape Town, the functional area of the city of Cape Town may well go well beyond the municipal boundaries of the Metropolitan Council of Cape Town. And therefore, it would be appropriate to locate it in the right area, but also deal with areas that are outside of those particular boundaries. And what we perceive to be a really appropriate arrangement would be a clear collaboration between provinces and metros in the instance where those cross-boundary areas arise and the rationalization is understood. But some agreement needs to be arrived at in relation to how you properly allocate the money. But we would envisage that if a metro is defined as a transport authority and not the province in that instance, that effectively the metro would take responsibility, as the NLTB suggests, and fully implement. The model of the transport authority's chair, as we have clearly articulated in the legislation, are really going to be dependent on what is appropriate for this very vast country of ours. If I may indicate, in Gauteng, it does not make sense to have transport authorities on a municipal boundary basis, because Gauteng is now really just one big city. So appropriately, the transport authority in that area is proposed to be a joint arrangement between provinces and the metro area that are covered there. So you would find that in the Eastern Cape, that arrangement is more appropriate in a particular way, where the metros may be able to take on the functions, but the province's responsibility is to assist the weaker district municipalities that exist in the various outside areas. So that's
going to end up having a little bit of an argument, but so let me not do that, because I think one needs to look at the statistics about travel patterns, which are interesting, even in Gauteng, where one assumes that it operates like a single, you know, transport entity. In fact, in practice, I think I haven't got it at my fingertips, but I think your own research shows that even for the city of Joburg, public transport, I think 95% of people are within the city and stuff. But you know, my main point at this point is that the envisaged solution to the problem that we're encountering now will accommodate both allocations to, for instance, a metro as well as to a province and so on. So that won't be a problem. That was my main point. Okay. Next point. Sorry, I'm hogging, but please members interrupt or whatever. The kilometres help. It's a more rational way and a better way, I think, than passengers. So it's good that also what we're talking about is a migration for out of the passenger numbers determining the subsidy towards kilometres. Because I think that's a better way of contracting, so that you're contracting around the provision of particular services, that you must run the service, and presumably the contract will drill down to saying you must run it late at night, because although there might be numbers of passengers, it's very important to provide public transport to those who need it and so forth. But we must be careful. I mean, obviously there will still be escalation pressures and often extremely unpredictable escalation pressures, not primarily to do with the oil price. So I think that, you know, and heavens knows where that's going. SAA made a catastrophic miscalculation on that once, if I'm not mistaken. It's very difficult, and therefore, while we might think that shifting into negotiated away from interim and towards kilometres away from passenger numbers determining the subsidy allocation, we mustn't imagine that it's not going to present a lot of challenges in terms and therefore there must be space for escalation, and the Budget Committee's got to be sensitive to this, and I'm sure it will be. When is it ever sensitive to these things? But we need to understand that there might also be de-escalation. I mean, that's not just because the oil price might go down, although I doubt it. It's gone down, but I don't think it's going to keep going down. But but as we rationalize the public transport system, part of what makes minibuses survivalist, except for the upper thing, is that they're competing with buses, they're competing with trains. What makes it difficult for bus operators is that they're competing with other modes and so on the same routes and so forth. And part of the integrated public transport thing is to make sure that there are viable businesses where they're not shooting each other, literally or figuratively, to get onto the routes. But also, it makes better sense. And therefore, we may find, and this has been a Latin American experience, is that they end up not having the best subsidies in some big cities, amazingly, and charge very low fares. In others, much in developed countries, public transport is subsidized indeed. But maybe we're subsidizing it by far too much because we're keeping afloat systems that are being undermined by irrationality of all kinds. Plus the spatial things that as we start to get up, and we haven't got, it's not as though we've improved the apartheid geography of our cities. If anything, they've remained stubbornly the same, if not worse, thanks to our 3 million low-cost RDP houses and so on, which have added to the burden of long-distance transport. So we've got to really get those things right as well. But there might also be patterns, because at a certain point in time, what you think is going to be kilometers traveled, because you're going to supply a bus every 15 minutes on this particular route between particular hours and so on, you might find that as numbers escalate, you've got to put more buses on. So in effect, you're running more buses and therefore driving more kilometers. So there's not an endless flexibility in terms of you've got the same number of buses and you're doing those kilometers. So that's exactly our policy, is to increase massively bus ridership, for instance, and to get people out of their cars. And we hope to impose traffic demand management. In other words, make it more difficult for cars to get into cities, and not least Joburg, where there's a really serious problem. Start to charge parking much more for parking. So that we want to put more and more people in. So again, there are a lot of escalation issues, and we must imagine that it's a complicated, and we mustn't allow our policies to be undermined by too tight a budgetary. We need to be very disciplined with budget, I've no doubt about it, but I'm just meant to, so I hope all of there's an understanding for all of that, that this is not just going to be so simple, it's going to be difficult, yeah. Okay. Sorry, I'm just seeking reassurances that all of this is being well thought through, and I'm being told absolutely no problem. Anything else that other members want to say?
There is very little reason to debate in this particular matter. Like as I said, that this debate is a political one. That's a long time to me to be debating some of these failures that we have. And one does hope that, because there's an education to actually mitigate this problem now. One is that it looks like we are going to see the services provided well into the near future, because the problem looks like we are informed that it is sorted out. We hope that we do not want to find ourselves in this kind of a situation. As I said, is that just to repeat several services, that we are not going to find ourselves in a situation again where cost actually has to make us to respond to things that we're supposed to respond to, or whether it matters. And as we also requested, of course, that the department, in the form of administration, they really become proactive in ensuring that service delivery is sustained, because we are just on the brink of a collapse, and they need to assist us. And also the advice should be really informed by service delivery, not 100% on financial prudence or whatever it may be termed in other terms. There must be an integration that we don't collapse service delivery because we want to be either seen as aces in financial management, because that doesn't help, it's contradictory. And as long as we get a proper mix and that we sustain services, I think we will be the happiest.
Thanks, Dennis.
Chipperson, thanks. Chipperson, I hear the department says that because of the budgeting
for these couple of years that, that escalated into this, into this area. And Treasury says that there was not 100% fiscal discipline, so to say. The matter is already in court. Are we now waiting for the court to decide how this matter can be resolved? The matter is now with us as the portfolio committee. Can we, I would like to go out satisfied that this is the progress, and this is what we're going to do. A much more simpler answer to this relationship.
Really, what the court cases are about contractual arrangements, and it's not for us to decide the niceties and complexities of that. But presumably, we would want, as a committee, to have the assurance from government that they will meet their whatever difficulties are. They will, and obviously, will have to meet their contractual obligations. It's their right to challenge the to explore what the terms of those contractual arrangements are, and insofar as that's done in the courts, that's fine. There's nothing problematic about it. The key thing is clearly government must meet its contractual obligations, and presumably we would ask for that reassurance. Secondly, we've been reassured, I think, that through a bit of scratching around the environment and some ad hoc measures, hopefully we can ensure that there won't be an implosion. And then we're told that from April, we should be on a much better footing. I mean, obviously it will be a struggle in terms of structural transformation, shifting to different forms of contracts and so on, which we'll do, and we'll certainly drive, and certainly I'm sure you have the support of Parliament in doing it. Yeah. Am I right in summarizing those as being the response to me?
Chairperson, I would like to confirm that through processes committed to by the three departments of Finance, Justice and Transport, a payment of $94 million was made to Golden Arrow, which settled the first case. This morning I am informed the Gauteng has paid the $126 million that was owed, and we have a process in place to deal with the other provinces, as we indicated, having given provincial heads of department instructions to go and find what you correctly indicate as particular measures in a much more flexible arrangement that allow them to incur this expenditure to take us and cover the months of December, January and February. The month of March basically falls into the next year, and we think the problem can be resolved. Also, importantly, in consultation with the various contractors by provincial heads of departments in those areas, so that they come to an agreement around the scheduling of, if you like, that debt in arrears over this period of the next 3 months, and an agreement that is mutually agreeable to. But we've, for instance, given the provinces and the treasury as indicated, and we've asked provincial treasuries to really allow for a little bit of flexibility around some of these areas so that we can deal with it. In fact, avert the crisis by dealing with administrative solutions that enable this payment to happen as a matter of priority.
Let's conclude, if that's okay. And thanks very much. Our colleagues, both from the Department of Transport and from Treasury. I think it was very important that you used Parliament to explain what I think at the public level has been confusing, a confusing area. And there's no shame in saying there have been some mistakes, and we're learning from those. And this is the way forward. No one else is going to solve this other than this government, okay? So to try and address Linus's concerns, which is not spelling out, but I think they have to do with electoral issues. I'd rather have a government that says, yeah, it's a complex area, and we all agree it's a very complex area. Legislation to help sort it out has been slow. The original legislation, and I was involved in that, the National Land Transport Transition Act, I think we became impractical in many respects, and we've been slow to change that and so on. So we must all take some responsibility for it. The point is, it's the people in this room, whether from Parliament or, and particularly from the government side, that are going to sort this out. And we won't sort it out unless we admit to challenges, problems, and perhaps mistakes that we've made or oversights that there have been. But above all, that we were determined to move forward now with what has to be done. And that means, one, changing the contract and moving to making sure at a municipal and provincial level there is effective management and oversight of these things. Fourthly, a willingness, which hopefully there will be, because hopefully they will have sobered up, insofar as they weren't sober, from the side of the operators, that they don't like interim contracts on the one hand, or they use interim contracts, let's put it like that, to say that's why they're not recapitalizing. Some of the bus services, Golden Arrow would be a prime example, patently are not recapitalizing, and yet we are subsidizing them to hundreds of thousands of rand, millions and millions of rand a year. And patently, what's on service, and that's publicly subsidized, the buses are in shocking condition, frankly, and look really old and tatty, many of them. And they've used the excuse, well, we don't know where we are, and we can't recapitalize because we don't know what our future is, we are on interim contracts. I understand from Sotaru that that they do better out of the interim contract in terms of money and also cash flow than they do from it. And the interim contracts are less, the ability for the authority, whether it's provincial authority or municipal authority or national authority, to supervise and manage more effectively. So we've got to do that. We're not trying to do the private bus operators out of a business. On the contrary, we want to ensure that they are able to provide an effective service to the public. But they might need a bit of pressure as well, and they're trying to bring pressure onto us to get their subsidy, and so far as the contract should apply, fine. But at the same time, they need to understand that all of this is unsustainable unless there's the willingness to transform and to move into a different kind of dispensation. But we've also then from the public side got to be prepared to do it. And then I think going forward, obviously there'll be more challenges than perhaps we think with moving to DORA and implementing and so on. But I think I'm reassured that puts us onto a much better wicket. So I think you really, very much, I think that it has been very important to use us as a way to, and I'm pleased to see there's a lot of media interest that there should be in this matter. So wish you well in the next complicated few days and weeks, because not all of it's quite ironed out, I get the impression, but you're telling us that in an interim way we're kind of there. And that really we've got to, well, we won't be here because we'll be voted out of office, but you guys need to hit the ground running after April, really make sure that we move in the direction that you're now outlining. Okay, thanks very much, everyone. Thank you. There's a report that we need to sign off on on the National Land Transport Act, and then we need to move the minutes.